Welcome to Transition, Gadgets 360's gaming and pop culture podcast. In today's episode, we are going to be talking about Yakuza Kiwami 2, Monster Hunter Generations Ultimate, and the second half of the show will be a pop culture special where Netflix's original series Ghoul will feature. So to talk about the gaming segment of this podcast, we have our games editor, Rishi Alwani.
Hey, hello.
Friend of the podcast, Mikhail Madnani.
Yes.
And I'm your host, Pranay Parab. So first things first, what is Yakuza Kiwami 2?
Okay, so Yakuza Kiwami 2 is basically a remake, remaster, reimagining, if you will, of Yakuza 2, which was a PS2 release.
And 12 years ago.
Yeah, 12 years ago. And it was... So the Yakuza series has been, until very recently, exclusive to the PlayStation consoles. That's because Sega made the games with Sony's assistance. And so the very first Yakuza game, I think, was in 2004-2005, called Yakuza 1. And then, yeah, Yakuza, just Yakuza. And when it released outside of Japan, it had voice acting from the likes of Mark Hamill. And it was marketed as Japanese GTA, which didn't help matters. It didn't end up doing too well.
Yeah, that's actually a big problem even now. Like, every time I try to tell somebody, okay, I love Yakuza 0 and, like, you should play it, everyone asks me the same question. Is it like GTA?
Yeah, so the thing is, it's not. Long story short, it's essentially, at its very core, it's a game where you basically, you know, explore a city, talk to people, beat the crap out of bad guys, and try to improve the lives of those around you as a member of the, or in this game, ex-member of the Yakuza. So Kiwami 2, in terms of series timeline, if we go by the canon timeline, if we go by the timeline of the actual, following Kazuma Kiryu, who's the protagonist of the series, well, you have Yakuza 0, Yakuza 1, or Yakuza Kiwami as it was remastered, and Yakuza Kiwami 2, or Yakuza 2 as it's known as. So it's like the third game. And it's fascinating because we've been playing a final build of the game. It's going to be out, I think,
August 28th.
And we've been playing final retail code. And it's pretty good. Surprisingly good.
So far.
I mean, I don't know about so far. And full. I mean, it's good. Let's just say we've played an insane amount of the game. And it's surprisingly a lot better than we went.
Kiwami 1 came out in August last year. It was a budget release. Didn't release in India.
Yeah.
Need to still tell people that. You can still get it on Amazon India if you want. There are like a ton of Steelbook copies. In fact, I know a few people who ordered some recently just to prep for Kiwami 2, which is releasing officially. What happened is, at the time, Sega and Atlus Games were going through this transition period, not a reference to the podcast name, where they were getting stuff published in Europe, and India comes under Europe for PlayStation, under Deep Silver. And Deep Silver does not have a distributor here. Or if they do, the distributor isn't doing a good enough job with a lot of titles. So Persona 5 didn't show up over here. Yakuza Kiwami 1 didn't show up over here officially. Probably still available on Amazon through third-party importers and stuff like that. You can still get Kiwami 1. And you should play it. Like, it's really good. But yeah, Kiwami 2, like, just even playing the demo which showed up, I think, a month ago or something. Well, let's just say, like, if you know the transition from Shadow of the Colossus on PS2 to how it is on PS4, this does that and more, I'd say.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a very apt way of putting it. Now, I mean, some of you may be a little bummed out that we're being a little vague, but fact of the matter is there is a bulletproof embargo on this game,
yeah,
on what we can and can't discuss. And it's all we can, and which is really tragic, because from a gameplay standpoint, it's quite fascinating. A lot of what they've essentially done is, and why Mike is making the reference to Shadow of the Colossus, is that firstly, the very first thing you see and what they've done is they've improved the visuals tenfold. The graphics look impeccably good. There's no screen tearing. There is aliasing in a few places, but it isn't as bad as it was on Yakuza 6. From a visual standpoint, this is perhaps the best looking Yakuza game I have played. I mean, but full disclosure, I haven't played Yakuza 0 on PC.
I have.
Mike
but
has.
Like, it's yeah, as of now, this is the best looking Yakuza game. Also, one of the best looking games I've played in general. Like, probably the best looking character models, aside from Naughty Dog stuff, I'd say.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that.
So yeah, like, when people keep comparing it to GTA, at least in terms of the visuals and in terms of dialogue and voice acting, I'd say, like, I mean, obviously the voice acting is in Japanese, but yeah, nothing comes close to this. And Yeah, another thing to look into is, like, whatever, when I was writing about it already, it's like this is the fourth game in less than 2 years now, or like a little over 2 years, like if you, whatever.
Yeah, Yakuza, less than 2 years, actually. Yakuza 0,
Yakuza 0 was Jan 2017, then August or July was Kiwami 1.
August was Kiwami 1.
Yeah, then March this year was Yakuza 6. August, now, like, whatever, a week from today, as of this recording, is Yakuza Kiwami 2. And then, like, 5 weeks later is Fist of the North Star, also known as Hokutoga Gotoku in Japan, which is, like, releasing here again. Pretty mind-blowing that, like, forget just the franchise having a resurgence in the West. The fact that we're getting them day and date in India with, like, Steelbook editions and all is pretty mind-blowing. So, yeah, very happy about that. But there's also the question where a lot of people are wondering, like, is it worth playing all these? Why are they releasing so many of them close to each other? And, well, this is what happens when you have a franchise that was lagging behind in the West and you need to catch up at some point, because the eventual game plan, I'm sure, for the series creators and for Sega in general is worldwide simultaneous releases and maybe multi-platform releases. That's what they've been hinting at now for Shin Yakuza or the next set of Yakuza games or whatever. Like, they said they want to get them on as many platforms as possible and all that. How that works with marketing deals and how that works with contracts with Sony and stuff remains to be seen. But yeah, the fact is, like, if you are enjoying these games, we're getting them in India day and date. We're getting them like priced really well also comparatively to other games and stuff like that. It's like, yeah, it's just a very good time to be a Yakuza fan over here.
Will they be in stock on day and date?
Yeah, so with Yakuza 0, that was a massive problem because it took the distributors by surprise.
Mm. It took everyone by surprise, I think.
So, if we look at it, what happened with... if we look at the Yakuza series in general in India, with Yakuza and Yakuza 2, both of them were published by Sega. Local distributors, E-Express. But at that time, they never did see mass appeal, even though they were priced really well. Yakuza 1 was, I think, $6.99. Yakuza 2 was $9.99, later dropped to $6.99 on PS2. But they didn't have that much of a mass audience. When we saw Yakuza 3, Yakuza 4, Yakuza Dead Souls, all of them were released here, and they were never at full price. They were always a little lower, like $2.499 or $1.999. Dead Souls, in fact, if you know our look, is still available, though we wouldn't recommend you play it. Dead Souls is basically the zombie versions of Yakuza during the time when zombies was a big deal.
Mm. So when are we getting Yakuza Battle Royale?
No, it's there in Yakuza 6 and Kiwami 2 with the clan creator.
Not the same thing.
It's the same thing. It's Battle Royale. But yeah, point is, that aside, yeah, so they've all the games have made, at least until Yakuza 4 and Dead Souls, all that made it here. But Yakuza 5 was a digital-only release outside of Japan. And it eventually made it to Europe and US as a digital download, and ended up being free on PS Plus for that month. This was towards the end of the PS3's life cycle. Now with Zero is a fascinating situation because Zero was actually published and published by Sega. So it had an India release, and it was surprisingly well priced. I think, what, $2.499?
Yeah, so Yakuza 0 was a $60 full price release abroad, and it made it here at $2.499, which is about 1,000 rupees less than what a full price release usually retails for. And the beginning of 2017 was basically like Japanese games' golden age of this gen, I'd call it, because early on, like, a lot of devs were struggling with PS4 and, like, Xbox One basically dead for Japan anyway. But yeah, it took them a while, and like they finally had, like, you have Nier Automata, you have Resident Evil 7, you have Yakuza 0, even the Kingdom Hearts collections showed up, Gravity Rush 2, basically it was a very good time. So yeah, it released at $2.499, it had really good reviews across the board, and yeah, so when, and also the fact that it was very expensive on PSN for some reason,
yeah,
pushed more people to physical, like even the people who'd want to get it digitally. I think it was about...
around 5,000 rupees.
So that was like, you basically play like half price and you get it physically. And Yakuza games don't really have big updates or patches or anything. And by the time they release in the West, they have everything on the disc, which is something which I'm very happy Sega does. So you get everything in a single package, which is really cheap comparatively. In fact, if you look at value for the quality, they should have charged like 10,000 rupees for Yakuza 0. But that's
don't give them ideas.
Yeah, so seriously.
So basically, $2.499 was it. Everything aligned well for that release, except for the distributor's quantity, because it was super hard to get the game after day one. People were wondering what to do. Some people resorted to importing it from Amazon USA, paying customs and all, because it was still ending up being cheaper than buying it on PSN. And yeah, like after that, at least Sega's been better with pricing on PSN. So, but yeah, now when we look at Yakuza 6 now, that was also a full price release.
Yeah, but then before 6, I mean, even if you look at Kiwami, Kiwami was, didn't make it here because, as Mike said, yeah, Deep Silver. But also, interestingly, Deep Silver did have an Indian distributor at a time. And when we did ask the distributor, Sundar Electronics, when we did ask them about Kiwami's release, his response was, what is Yakuza? So that didn't make it here, even though Grey Market filled the void. There was it was also supposed to come in through Deep Silver's Middle East distributor at the time, GK Electronics, but that and through as an Amazon exclusive. But that never panned out either. So, I mean, that's why. So Kiwami is the tougher one to find. Kiwami 2, thankfully, wouldn't have that problem. 6 also was thankfully published by Sega. So we got it here on time and that was a little cheaper.
Yeah, the art book edition showed up here. I think that's the only one still available here. But no, the problem with Kiwami at the time was because it didn't show up here officially, it means the price is going to be a little higher. And even though that was a $30 release abroad, it actually ended up being more expensive than Yakuza 0 was. So a lot of people held off on buying it at launch at least. Now, obviously, everything has dropped in price, at least the original games and stuff, so it's worked out well. But yeah, we're still getting Yakuza games slightly cheaper than they are abroad. So yeah, $299 here, when they are usually $50 or $60 and you get like a steelbook or artbook edition, so it's good.
Yeah, but in terms of what you get with Kiwami 2, so as we talked about a little earlier, the visuals are pretty good. The gameplay is pretty sweet as well. As in, if you're a fan of how Yakuza 6's combat was, you're going to have a good time here. There's very little in terms of a learning curve. On top of that, yes, the restaurants. So what I noticed, at least with Yakuza 6, is that if you ended up going to the sushi restaurants, you could boost your stats a lot more across each stat you have. But then here it's not like that. Here other restaurants give you better bonuses. And there are the set bonuses also, wherein if you go to a place like Smile Burger and you have a burger and a fries and you have everything on the menu in one go, you end up getting the menu bonus, which again gives you a stat boost while you're in combat and stuff. So there is some depth where that's concerned. The mini games are a lot better this time around as well. You have the usual standbys like Virtual On and you have the UFO Catcher. But there's enough for people to get lost in even once you're done with the core gameplay. I mean, every sub story, every submission, and the sub stories are pretty cool. So like there's a sub story which has you bringing a comedy group back together. There's another sub story that has you trying to catch basically going into an arcade and trying to win a stuffed toy for a guy to give to his girlfriend, and they break up and stuff like that. It's quite hilarious. Then there's even other sub stories where you're trying to make sure a guy gets off the roof because he had lost his will to live, because the girl he was giving gifts to was basically rebuking him. It's quite hilarious. So there are a ton of cool sub stories this time around as well.
But then if you haven't played Kiwami 1, there's like a very detailed flashback where you recollect your memories of what happened.
Oh yeah, I read about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So they've done it really well. There are some slight changes to make the stuff appropriate for this, because while this is a remake and reimagining of Yakuza 2, there are some changes slightly. At least I haven't played Yakuza 2, but I've been reading they've changed some stuff. But yeah, at least within the first four chapters, really good sub stories, a lot of like basically really good. Feels like a upgrade on Yakuza 6 in almost every aspect, I'd say. Performance, visuals, gameplay, combat, exploration, just everything's a lot better so far.
Tell me more about the Majima side of things, because from what I know, Majima wasn't a big part of Kiwami 1. So
no, he actually was a very big part of Kiwami 1.
He was a big part of. So
it was like basically a whole game mechanic where, like in Yakuza 0, you had that Mr. Shakedown or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So in Yakuza, Kiwami...
Majima Anywhere or what?
Majima Anywhere is the system where basically he's not happy with how you are after you come back from prison, which happens in the beginning of the game. So he wants to get you back to speed and get the Dragon of Dojima back. So he's testing you and he shows up randomly anywhere. Like when you're walking, a cop will stop you and it turns out it's Majima. Or when you're walking, suddenly like a manhole cover lifts on the ground and he's like, let's fight now. Or you're just walking randomly, he jumps off a roof also. I think that happens. So.
Yeah, so the point is like, so if Majima didn't have a big role in the original Yakuza. So what they did with Kiwami is that and because of his popularity in Yakuza 0, they thought, okay, why not give him a bigger role in Kiwami? So which is why they've added him as a mechanic in Kiwami. So yeah, they've had, as Mike said, had to, retcon
like
a few things.
They mentioned like on the official Kiwami 2 website, there's like a nice explanation on how this works and all in the game and all. And yeah, there is let's just say if you liked Yakuza 0 a lot, there's a lot to like over here for that.
Fine. So basically, there is, I mean, you can play. So once you're done with the single player, there's a Majima section where you can play as him. And it fleshes out his story after 0 and around the events of Kiwami 2.
Okay, cool. I'm guessing, you know, the embargo is really making you hold back, and we'll fix that in the next episode.
Yeah, it's a weird one this time. It's a very weird one. From a narrative standpoint and what can be talked about, it's a really weird one.
All right. So, August 28th is the release. Yeah. And
Steelbook edition is, as of now, only the Steelbook is going to be available in India, but the distributor did say that the standard edition would be available soon after. Or
yeah,
whatever.
But no one cares. I mean, you know, everyone should get the Steelbook. It's fine.
Everyone should get both.
I think I'm with Pranay on this. If you can pick up the Steelbook, that's good enough.
It's at the same price. So, yeah. You know, yeah. It really doesn't make any difference. And the cover is beautiful. So just get that.
But yeah, we should have our full review in the days to come.
Yeah, sure thing. Then now I want to talk about Monster Hunter Generations Ultimate.
That's a mouthful. So Monster Hunter wasn't a big deal in the West when it was on PSP and when it was on PS2 at the time. In Japan, obviously, at that time, the market was moving towards handhelds and stuff. And obviously, Monster Hunter wasn't possible on the DS. So when the 3DS was a thing, they did Monster Hunter Tri or Monster Hunter 3. And they had it on PSP also in Japan, because in Japan, a lot of publishers and developers try and go on as many things as they can over there. But what happened in the West is, like, there seemed to be some marketing deal or some tie-up with Nintendo at the time. So and usually in the West, Monster Hunter games used to release only as the Ultimate version around that time. So when a Monster Hunter game releases in Japan, you have your base game, which is a ton of content. And about a year later, they release the G version of it, which adds a super high rank called G rank, which is super hard and built around multiplayer and stuff like that, which is very, very difficult. So they used to release like Monster Hunter 3G, Monster Hunter 4G. Those versions came to the West as Ultimate. So you had 3 Ultimate, which was on the Wii U and on the 3DS. And you had Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate, which was only on the 3DS. This was like the most popular one. Nintendo published and marketed it in some regions. It did really well for the franchise and all. After that, they did a spin-off game, which was called Monster Hunter Generations, which is like the greatest hits of Monster Hunter, which had stuff from all the other games, extra stuff and all. This was also 3DS exclusive. This game in Japan received something called Monster Hunter Cross over there. So that got the expansion and it became Double Cross. Yeah. That got ported to the Switch last year, and Capcom said there are no plans to localize this. A year has passed since then, like literally a year since that release, and now it's releasing in English and it's releasing in India also officially as Monster Hunter Generations Ultimate, which is basically the Switch version of the G version of the 3DS version. Yes.
Yeah, that's literally what it is.
So and basically it has the, like, if you're looking at it in terms of pure content, it has probably like the most content in any Monster Hunter game ever, double or triple the time of previous games. But back to your original point, Monster Hunter World came out as a brand new, like it's a new mainline entry for PS4, Xbox One, and recently PC. This is a very different game. Like, even though both of them are in the Monster Hunter franchise, this is a very different game in a lot of ways. Like, I wouldn't even, it's a spin-off game, obviously, but in terms of gameplay and in terms of quality of life stuff, it's very different to World. So World improved on a lot of stuff, but because it's a new game, it's like a fresh start for a lot of people. There isn't as much content in that. Like, there's a ton of stuff to do. You can spend hundreds of hours in it, like, without filler stuff. But it's nowhere near Monster Hunter Generations Ultimate. Now, because Generations Ultimate is, like, a greatest hits thing so far and all, I've already played Generations on the 3DS and, like, a bit of it on the Switch now. It's, like, very different from World. So, you can't, like, if you're used to the quality of life stuff where you can use your analog stick and you have a radial menu for items and all, you can't do that anymore. It's still using the old-fashioned, like, basically the shoulder button switch for items and stuff like that. Then, when you have a potion, you still do this stupid animation, like you've become Superman or something, which you cannot skip for some reason, and they haven't fixed that, obviously, because it's an older game. So, if you do that when a monster's attacking you, you can try being Superman and flexing, you'll just get destroyed. So, you have to, like, time the stuff carefully. World was also built as a more social thing where, like, they encourage everyone to play together in this living hub world. And also, the whole world itself is more dynamic. Over here, it's a little more intimate, where it's just you and the monster. You can't actually use the environment as such to your advantage, where you, like, climb stuff, jump, or, like, you know, shoot stuff and it'll fall on the monster. Stuff like that is not possible over here. most of the areas, in fact, at least in the early parts of the game, are a lot like, they're pretty flat. And you just have like flat terrain and all. You have like very good monsters and stuff like that. So it's as you will, like, like the best way I can go to describe this is, if Monster Hunter World is like your favorite band's new album, Monster Hunter Generations Ultimate is like the greatest hits remastered. That's basically what the game is in terms of content and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, and while that would hold true for those who have been fans of the series before Monster Hunter World, for those who have been playing Monster Hunter World and have a Switch and decide, hey, why not check this out? It's a very, very different game. And as Mike said, you're not going to get the same quality of life. You're not going to get the same fidelity. You're not going to get the same, you know, feel versus that game. And that's something to keep in mind. So, yeah, I mean, we've been playing it for a bit. The game is going to be out, I think, towards the end of the month.
Same day as Kiwami 2.
Yeah, same day as Kiwami 2, August 28th. So, and it's, I mean, it's basically, I mean, as he said, you know, a souped up upgrade version of the 3DS version of the game. So that's the thing. And also another thing to keep in mind is, while there is a multiplayer component to it, it isn't also as robust as it would be versus Monster Hunter World. That's just a bunch of things to keep in mind, because right now, if you look at it, Monster Hunter World has become Capcom's one of their most successful games of all time.
The last thing says it's the best-selling game ever now.
Yeah, it's the best-selling game
this
ever.
This doesn't even count the seemingly 2+ million copies across Vgame and Steam on PC.
Yeah, so that's the point. It's done exceptionally well. And it's really easy for a lot of newbies just to jump in, because, you know, it's popular. But fact of the matter is, and we cannot stress this enough, there is a learning curve. And there's a learning curve to this as well. So if expecting this to be similar to Monster Hunter World or similar to, you know, a ton of other action games that are out there, it's not. It's a very different beast in itself. And there are a lot of other things to keep in mind. Your weapon setup, your armor setup, what's more comfortable for you to use. Animations, as Mike was talking about, your potion animations, you can't use them at the wrong time. There is a learning curve. Prepare to be humbled if you're used to easier games. And that's something we would say at this point in time for this. The Switch performance seemed pretty interesting. It actually did quite well, both docked and handheld.
I mean, yeah, so basically, visually, it's a huge upgrade over 3DS. If you look at comparison videos, the 3DS one looks like you're watching a YouTube video at 144p buffering and stuff like that in comparison. Yeah. Now, what Capcom has done in the past is with Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate on the 3DS, like, there are two models of the 3DS. There's a new 3DS which has better internals, kind of like the iPhone 5 and 5S difference over there. So for Monster Hunter 4, they actually had an unlocked frame rate for the newer model. So it actually went like between 45 and 60 in a lot of cases, which was for some people not as good as playing at lock 30. But yeah, that's how it was. With Generations, they just went with lock 30 across the board. And that's carried over here. Now, while a few people will be like, why is it not 60 FPS? It's a 3DS game ported. Well, it's technically not. It actually has a lot going on for it visually. There's like huge areas in some cases. The monster animations, the monster AI is very good. It's not just like you're just fighting some big beast like in Toukiden or God Eater, which is like pretty bad AI. So over here, it is locked 30 FPS across the board. Now, that's a lot better than what, at least in my experience on the Xbox and PS4, including PS4 Pro versions of Monster Hunter World. Capcom has not fixed the performance on consoles for Monster Hunter World, including the Xbox One X. There are fluctuations here and there because of how they handle volumetric lighting, which is one of the more taxing features on PC. Some people who disable that in the menu get like 5 to 10 FPS extra across the board. So yeah, it's 30 FPS locked, no issues in both handheld and docked modes. It runs at native resolution in both, so it's 720p docked, 720p handheld, 1080p docked. And yeah, it has good use of HD Rumble as well when you use your Hunter Arts. That's the big addition to this game compared to a normal Monster Hunter. You have these special skills which let you do stuff like jump in the air and do a huge lunge, or you have like a huge escape maneuver which gives you a lot of iframes to just escape out, or you have like other abilities which let you just super fast attacks and stuff like that. So there's a ton of customization over here. But thankfully, there's like a very nice set of training quests for people who've never played Monster Hunter, which let you get your bearings and learn the controls and stuff like that. And yeah, like the first few hours with the English version, I'd say, because played a ton of the Japanese version last year. So been really good so far. Now, if you're wondering if this is a good game to get into if you've never played Monster Hunter, it is, but it also isn't, because there's some stuff which might annoy you, but if you're willing to put in the effort, so far it'll be worth it. Because over here, unlike World, you have a separate single player set of quests and a campaign. Story isn't like as big a deal as it is in World, but you still have something over here. And the multiplayer stuff is completely separate. In Monster Hunter World, you have both together. Like, you can do stuff with everyone. You can do stuff on your own. Stuff like that. But, yeah, you can start with this, but you need to, like, just don't expect to be able to play it like you will play a modern action game. That would be easier for you to get into World if you want something like that. But if you want a portable Monster Hunter, yeah, this is the best one by far. So
yeah, and that being said, we won't be surprised if Capcom eventually releases a modern-style Monster Hunter game on Nintendo platforms. It's just a matter of time. And why I'm pretty confident saying that is because they've slowly been releasing their catalog on the Switch. We've seen them bring Resident Evil games. We've seen them bring Street Fighter games, a couple of them. We've seen them bring a bunch of Mega Man titles. It's just a matter of time. Plus, they also have a little experiment going on in Japan wherein you can play Resident Evil 7 via the cloud. Now, debatable if that's the best way to play that game. But the fact of the matter is, they seem to be interested in capitalizing on the Switch's user base and its popularity. That being said, I won't be surprised if they do end up doing it. It will probably be a lot less complex from a technical standpoint versus their other output. But yeah, something to look forward to if you want something new to play on the Switch. But keep in mind, yes, there is a learning curve.
Yeah,
and also there is a demo you can check out if you want to see the performance. But keep in mind that the demo is basically like a mid-game setup. So you already have a custom character with some abilities and stuff like that. You can choose your weapon, but you have like 3 quests to try out in the demo, like easy, normal, and hard in terms of monster difficulty. You can play this online also, so you can check out how the netcode works. But the online infrastructure for the demo is a little different from the main game so far. So just keep that in mind. And yeah, you can, like, if you want to see how combat is, but there's no tutorial in the demo, just give it a shot to just see how the performance and visuals are at least before picking up the main game. So yeah, and if you did play Monster Hunter Generations on the 3DS, you can transfer your save, but there are some caveats over here because the game releasing in India is the Europe copy of Monster Hunter Generations Ultimate. Not sure if it'll let you transfer from the USA version of Generations because that's the version which a lot of people would have played in India, considering on the 3DS and Wii U, India used to get NTSC stock. Everything is region free now on the Switch, but yeah, like you might want to wait till launch to get clarity on whether you can transfer your save or not.
Yeah, that's pretty much something to keep in mind. But yeah, that's basically it.
Cool. So the games we've been playing this week. So, well, Mike, you want to go first?
Kiwami 2 Monster Hunter Generations Ultimate. Also, a bit of the Fist of the North Star Lost Paradise demo again, which is currently available only on PSN in Japan and Asia. Yeah, basically said what I had to on Kiwami 2 and Monster Hunter Generations Ultimate. We'll probably talk beyond Chapter 4 of Kiwami 2 next week.
Okay, Rishi?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's the usual stuff, Kiwami 2, Monster Hunter Generations Ultimate, but also been playing quite a bit of Dead Cells on the Nintendo Switch. That's been really good. I mean, like, it's one of the few roguelikes I actually like, so that's saying a lot. The animations are next level. The game design's impeccable. The level design's impeccable. So, been playing a lot of that. And aside from Dead Cells and the other stuff, been revisiting the older Yakuza games. 6, 0, Kiwami, just to see how they stack up versus Kiwami 2. So, that's what I've been playing. And all goes well, prepping for the inevitable, Spider-Man. So, you know, just looking at other stuff like Arkham, looking at other stuff like the past Spider-Man games. So yeah, that's what I've been doing.
Yeah, so I've been playing 2 games. One is Pocket City, which Mike recommended. It's a SimCity like game on iOS. Finished one city, I think, like I'm at level 113. Basically, it's an endless thing. You can just keep building your city, keep raising your level slowly. So most of the missions are done now. I think only thing left in this game is probably like to complete it in expert mode and hard mode, which I don't know if I'm going to be doing. But anyway, enjoyed the game. Everyone should play it. It's a really good game. No in-app purchases, nothing. Just a single purchase and play the full game. Then, playing this other game called Persona 5. And in that, I have acquired a new WoW, which is not to buy any more games until I finish Persona 5.
So, never.
Yeah, probably. Anyway, so gotten about 12-13 hours into the game. I've been playing a bit slowly, trying to collect as many chests as possible, but it is a bit annoying because like I reached a couple of locked chests and I didn't have enough lockpicks with me to get all the loot in them.
Just root the chest, dude. Install custom ROM.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, if it was Persona 5 Gingerbread or something, sure, why not? Anyway, so yeah, this I've been attacking that Kamoshida's castle right now. So finish the part where you reach the treasure, and then after that you have to apparently, you know, like the before the boss fight can happen, you have to take a day's break and send him a calling card or something. So I'll be doing that, and yeah, in the meantime, just looking at things like reading books and feeding the plant in my room in the attic of that cafe. And overall, enjoying it. I really like the combat mechanic in this. Even though it's at easy mode, it's quite challenging. Some of the like fights are really difficult. So you have to actually, like, if you don't play with a guide, like I am playing, then it's going to be really difficult. Because some of these people who attack you, the shadows, they are like at level 16, 17, while you are at level 7, 8 in the beginning. And only way to actually like do some damage to them without like seriously getting beaten up is if you know their weakness. So that's the only cheat code I'm using, which is like just find out each shadow's weakness in the beginning and then attack them directly. So that's the like one way I'm cheating, but otherwise, yeah, playing the game pretty much as I would play any other game, which is just explore every dungeon possible, like find all treasure as much as possible, and don't skip anything. So yeah, hopefully I'll be doing that Kamoshida boss battle pretty soon. But to get there, like, there was this one monster which I had to defeat, and it looked like a, you know, a male anatomical body part. So yeah, the game has some really, really strange shadows.
Design, yeah,
yeah. So there's like a one of the shadows looks like a horse with like a mermaid's you know, like lower half.
Yeah, they do some weird stuff in terms of their monster design, in terms of the personas you also capture.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's basically in a lot of ways a very darker take on Pokemon.
Mm.
And I think it's, to me, it's one of the reasons to keep coming back. I mean, and if you think it's weird now, as someone who's spent, I think, over 80 hours in the game, you haven't seen anything yet.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. So this is what I like about this game. Like, every time I think that, okay, what more can they do with the story, they expand and they make it like much more interesting. So initially I was like, okay, these guys are like, the game starts with that thing where this guy is sent on probation to another school. So I was like, okay, it's a high school thing, why am I even bothered? And then suddenly, you know, this whole monster thing starts and the castle, you attack it. And then now that I've reached pretty much the end of that castle and I'm waiting on the boss fight, I'm pretty sure like by the time I finish that boss fight, something else will come up and then the story will grow even bigger. So the only thing that's really like keeping me hooked right now is knowing that, okay, there's that interrogation scene which is happening.
Yeah, the flashback scene.
Yeah, and also like right at the beginning of the game, there was that really nice combat scene where you had like your full powers and all that and you got caught. So these two things are keeping me hooked to the bigger story. But right now, you know, they like the way they expand the story is pretty gradual, and I like the way they've done it.
Yeah, that's what I've noticed. A lot of the Japanese developers tend to do this really well, where when you're done with the game, you realize it's actually a very straightforward tale, but the way it's presented to you and how it's presented to you is actually what matters. And what story elements are placed to you at the beginning, middle, and end actually make a difference and want to keep you coming back to play.
Yeah, and you know what? Like, the best thing I have seen in this game, really, like, even though the story and all is good, combat is amazing, is the way the like UI is designed. Like, even now, every time I like go up a level or pull off an all-out attack move or something, you know, in which like I kill the monster, then there's like this really nice graphic which looks like graffiti. So overall, like, that is something that I don't think I've seen in any game ever, and I've played quite a few games so far. So somehow the Western developers don't really get this well.
Supergiant Games Transistor's UI is impeccable. So I'd compare, like, those two are probably my favorite game UIs. Even XCOM Enemy Unknown did a really good job at game UI and all, but too bad about what happened to XCOM 2. So
yeah, I kind of agree. I mean, XCOM Enemy Unknown on consoles and PC is pretty much spot on.
It's just really good. It's a really good game across the board, which is why XCOM 2 is just more disappointing. So.
All right, I think that's all we have for this segment of Transition, and we'll be back right after the break with pop culture nerds Royden Serejo and Akhil Arora to talk about Netflix's Ghoul. Stay tuned. We're back after the short break to talk about Ghoul, which is Netflix's original series. It's a part of a wave of Netflix originals that are based in India and probably made by Indian production houses with Indian actors, etc. So Ghoul is one of these shows, and this follows Sacred Games, I think. So to talk about this, we have our pop culture nerd, that's Akhil Arora.
Hey everyone.
We have another pop culture nerd, that's Royden Serejo.
Hey, what's up?
Wearer of many hats, including deputy reviews editor at Gadgets360. And I'm your host, Pranay Parab. So, just before we started recording this, Royden had a lot to say about Ghoul.
Yeah.
But before we
we'll get
to
that later.
Yeah, yeah, I'll just describe the show quickly. Ghoul is essentially a horror show. So what happened with Ghoul is, I think the production was pretty much wrapped up when Netflix picked it up. So it's not a show that Netflix has produced, but it's a show that Netflix has acquired. Now, this is a 3-episode miniseries, which, as I mentioned earlier, is a horror show based on this Arabic folklore where a ghoul is a kind of a monster.
Supernatural entity.
Yeah, that can possess human bodies and like make them do crazy stuff, as we find out in the TV show.
I'm not sure possess is the right thing. It can take the form of humans.
Yeah, that's more accurate.
So it ends up creating a duplicate thing.
Yeah, duplicate. So this ghoul, it can be summoned by, according to the folklore, it can be summoned by like making some kind of a promise after spilling blood. So
basically, like sort of selling your soul. Yeah.
So selling your soul. So in this series, it's all about the most interesting thing, at least I felt, was the setting. It's, you know, starts with this wall of text where they say that it's set in the near future, where sectarian violence has really risen up, and they have text such as what, scheduled religious zone 12 or something like that, where a bunch of people from a particular religion are like sort of kept and monitored, much like the stuff we've seen in movies such as which one was that, District 9?
It felt like they were drawing on like two different things that came to me was George Orwell and Ray Bradbury. Ray Bradbury, obviously, because of like the visuals which people have probably seen in the trailer of them banning and then burning books, which is pretty prominent in the Bradbury
Fahrenheit 451.
Exactly. And obviously, Orwell came from the whole like scheduled like regions part where people are living in everything, different areas, restricted to like how they can sort of even their thought, right? Because like that's what the government is trying to control. We see in the early minutes of the first episode is that the government is trying policing what can people read, what can people think, how can people behave in society, and so forth.
Yeah. So that episode was interesting in some ways and disappointing in others. But, before we go into that, I always keep forgetting this. We are not going to be, like, giving you any spoilers about the plot, but we are going to be, there will be some mild spoilers, nothing major. Essentially, we are not going to be talking about episode 3 that much, but episode 1 and 2 we'll be talking about in quite a bit of detail, because the first two episodes are sort of the ones that set up the whole series, and third is when everything, like, all the action happens, everything comes to a, like, you know, heady conclusion. So in the first episode, as we mentioned earlier, it's set in the near future where like the sectarian violence, etc., is happening, and it starts with this scene where like in a car, a Maruti ST of all cars, in the near future.
I don't know how that's the future.
It's coming back.
That's
what happened in Looper as well, right? The old cars are back.
In the near future, in a Maruti ST, main protagonist. The protagonist of the series is Nida Rahim, played by portrayed by Radhika Apte. So she is in a car with her father, and they are both discussing like how their rights have been clamped down, etc. And Nida Rahim appears to be completely appears to have completely bought into the state's propaganda, which is that, you know, all of these people deserve to be here and all that, and you should not study things outside the syllabus. Whereas a father is slightly more rebellious. And there is that typically Indian scene over there where, like, they reach that naka of sorts, which is like a barricade, where people from the police or other security forces stop them, and then Nida is like, here, see my ID? And they are like, oh, you are from NPS? Which brings us to, you know, what the main security agency in this miniseries is. It's the National Protection Service.
Yeah, but NPS. See, right there was my first issue with that scene, right? She waits for her father to get dragged out of the car, manhandled, and then she shows her badge. Like, why not just flash your badge in the beginning itself?
That tells you something about the protagonist, right? That the character is not willing to sort of use that badge to sort of... Because like, as Pranay said,
she's bought into the propaganda of the nation that sort of is this now fascist entity.
Okay.
So because like she believes the that everything should be done how the government says, the new government says, she will not a person who will go outside that willingly to use herself and then put herself above the government.
Yeah, so right before that scene, there is that, like her father reveals, na, as soon as the car is stopped, that his lecture notes are in the back. So she says that, you know, I mean, his lecture notes are obviously from outside the syllabus, which is approved by the government, right? And they look down upon this. And partly there is also like a strong theme of discrimination happening against that. So in this, we are shown that, I mean, the father's community is discriminated against. Mm. And he feels strongly about that. He thinks that these arrests and all are, you know, completely like illegal and all. And he is trying to revolt against the system by sort of, you know, teaching his own syllabus. At least that's what is shown in the series.
Yeah, I mean, but they don't really explain as to why that has come about. Like, why has this, why are they banning and burning? Like, the scene where they're burning books, there are even, you can clearly see there's a book of nursery rhymes.
And geography.
Yeah, so like, why is that happening? Like, why are you even banning nursery rhymes?
Yeah, that, so that's that not brings really explained, us back right? to Akhil's explanation about Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, right? In that book, what happens is firemen are essentially people who burn
That's their literally job. Like earlier they were figurative firemen, now they're literal firemen.
They're supposed to burn all materials which are not approved by the government. And in that book specifically, it's like books are banned.
Okay.
So all books are like just constantly being torched, you know, whether it's approved or not. So like in this one, I think there was like a reference to, an homage, if you want to, to Bradbury. But it wasn't like very clearly explained as to why this is happening. But in a miniseries, that's sort of to be expected. You can't have them like setting up the plot over like six
especially
episodes.
Especially when the miniseries is not about that. It's just, that's the backdrop to the story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, while I did like that episode a lot because of, you know, the way it started, it really got me into the series and I really wanted to know what happens next. But what happens next is everything happens in that prison chamber, right? I mean, essentially like just in that
bunker.
One building. So I think maybe the creators ran out of budget after shooting the first episode and they're like...
And it clearly shows.
The truth of the matter is that actually Ghoul started a life as a firm because I just like interviewed the cast and crew today, so I know. So it began life as a film, which is why you can actually see the signs of it fitting within film, which is why it's only 3 episodes. Like even otherwise, miniseries are at least 5, 6, or 7 episodes at the least. So which is why I think it's gone from like being a 2-hour film to... If you put all of it together, it's actually just 2 hours, I think 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's not really expanded that much. It's just been like sort of slightly stretched to make sure it fit like 3 episodes. And even then, it's not like 3 Netflix hour episodes where it's 58 or 59 minutes. It's actually 45 to 48 minutes or something.
So yeah, that sort of explains some things, which is, you know, why things that happen in episode 1. I mean, there's almost no connection to that in episode 2 and 3, except for Nida Rahim and like the constant... the constant slurs that accompany her in the prison, which is essentially, this person is from that community, so they will not be able to take on these terrorists who are also from the same community. So apart from that, I don't think there's any other connection to what happens in episode 1, which is where the disappointment comes in, right? So
yeah, for me, I mean, what you spoke about is sort of conquers for me a lot on several stages. Like when the show started sort of with the whole explanation of the sectarian violence and the socio-political aspects they were covering, I was hoping for at least like a few minutes that all the trailers we had seen were actually false marketing and that the show was actually about this. And I was like, this is going to be great. But like, and obviously I soon found out that was not going to be the case, but this was actually just a supernatural horror story set in sort of one or two rooms and about like a few individuals and not about the larger climate. And if the series is successful and if Netflix won the second season, then I would love for them to explore that aspect instead of going with another sort of like Ghoul aspect to it.
Okay. So, do you think there is a chance that this will get a second season? Because I personally don't think so.
I highly doubt it. I think at the end, they've made it pretty clear that they wrap it up pretty... I mean, you know what's going to happen and it's a pretty like a... I wouldn't say obvious, but it's like a very safe ending that they have. And I don't think there's no cliffhanger. There's no scope left for...
And even the ending they have, like, even if they want to continue it, it'll be continued in a fashion that it'll become another supernatural horror story. I don't see it how they can go
back
to... Yeah,
going in any other direction.
How they can go back to the social political aspects. I feel like that's basically a backdrop that all of us are interested in and we want more of, because also dystopian dramas is not something we've seen much from India a lot. It's something we've always had to go to the Western UK or US stories, like Children of Men or District 9, actually, which was from South Africa. So there are anomalies here, but I feel like we haven't seen those. So obviously we crave those stories. But I don't see that obviously happening with Ghoul.
So one of the creators is actually not from India.
Right, yeah. Actually, yeah. The main guy himself, because yeah. The writer and director is British.
Yeah,
he's been working here for 8 years, but yeah, he's not from India.
Yeah, so maybe that's why we see that kind of a backdrop. If you say Britain, then immediately you think of things.
Yeah,
that
and even in an interview, he said today that he's a fan of dystopian dramas.
Yeah.
And I brought up like Orwell and Bradbury to him. He was like, he sort of almost acknowledged that he sort of wanted to get that into the show.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know if why this happens, but you know, maybe from India we don't have that kind of a background of looking at drama that way, where we portray this kind of post-apocalyptic shows maybe, or you know, some kind of a dystopia which happens in the near future. I don't know, I've not seen much of that.
Maybe it doesn't happen India. Because we're sort of almost living in a half dystopia.
Well, maybe that's a recent phenomenon and not exactly something that existed forever.
Our country was born from literally almost like a post-apocalyptic scenario.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it that way, yeah, sure. I mean, we've always been living in that kind of a scenario
born from darkness. So I feel like this, which is why most of our like content is sort of like projects optimism, right? Because we feel like we want to go towards a state where we just have better lives. Because like everyone, I'm sure like dystopian drama is not going to be as successful in a country where people's lives aren't that like enriched in the first place.
Yeah, fair enough. So coming back to Ghoul, from an acting standpoint, I didn't think there was that much to comment on, honestly. I think it was more the story, the setting, the horror in this that kept me hooked. But I can't really maybe recall any specific performance that I say, you know, would probably win an award or something.
I think I would have to agree. Like, there wasn't any one performance that really kept me hooked onto it. And even the script was kind of weak as well. I mean, there wasn't any great dialogue or the delivery. I mean, it was just like, okay, it's just like something you watch. It's not something that really got me hooked.
What I thought was that some of the personalities were more interesting than their dialogue. For example, that second in command at the prison, that Lady Lakshmi Das, who keeps speaking in a Bengali accent.
Yeah.
So I thought they had captured that very well, in the sense that how somebody from Bengal would speak and like what kind of things they would say and all that. But maybe not in terms of like actual dialogue, anything that could have been more impactful. I don't seem to remember like a single dialogue that I'll remember, except for maybe what I saw in the trailer, which is "Wo Ghoul Hai." So yeah, what did you think, Akhil?
From a character standpoint, like I agree with what you said. What I did notice was, I think, which I liked, was that the writing did not sort of steep into the tropes that horror films tend to do historically, is that they, the violence is always targeted towards women, which is a good relief to not have in a show, especially when the main character is female. The show could have easily gone that direction, but it does not, which is encouraging. And the fact that they have another second sort of powerful deputy character, as you said, the Bengali person, that brings another sort of facet to it, because it doesn't feel like otherwise like one female surrounded just by like men, because that's what happens. But the thing is, all the prisoners are men anyway, all the interrogators are men, it's only her. So it's nice to have that sort of balance. But that said, the writing does not, I feel like, never goes beyond sort of achieving just its basic aims of providing horror. It could have like, I mean, the recent horror films that have sort of really worked are A Quiet Place and Hereditary. And the reason they have worked is because they've invented on the horror genre. So A Quiet Place went with this. Horror movies rely on two things, right? Jump scares, or like on the audio side, they rely with like, they spook you. They go from like eerie quiet to like loudness. And A Quiet Place literally just like did away with that. Like, they're like, no, you don't care about sound, and we'll still give you a good story. Hereditary went another direction, and they got characters into it, which was like made it eerie instead of relying on visuals and audio. So in that sense, I feel like Ghoul doesn't experiment enough to boldly go somewhere new. It's happy to sort of just deliver what its basic aims are, which is why I felt like we were talking about, right? That the fact we were liking the dystopian aspects, social political aspects, and did not expand on that. It just went for a normal story about an entity appearing as human and tormenting everyone.
Yeah, I still say this though. The first episode is gripping enough to get you hooked.
Right.
That they've done for sure. But what follows maybe does not. I mean, I don't know. After watching this thing, I felt like the first episode was a complete waste because it had almost nothing to do with episode 2 and 3.
Yeah, I was like, felt like the opposite. Yeah. I was like, I was hoping the first episode like gave everything, but then the next two episodes did not really deliver for me because one, obviously, I'm not a fan of horror in the first place. So that's a slight bias there. The second thing is that it doesn't like do something new. I feel like kind of coming back to that is that it shows this like. Entity, like the first episode ends with that, right? The first episode ends like these dogs going crazy, and like you can clearly tell that something is supernatural here, and it picks that up and it just takes away with it, and it doesn't let the characters even sort of like realize that ever. The characters just keep throwing the same thing at them. They keep going with Bronn. Like it starts with like torturing him, and it ends with like a guy who is like apparently is famous at torturing, like the Fallout thing. So the characters never realize that. Clearly, Bronn is not working. Maybe they should try another psychological strategy. Yeah. And this, which is like kind of makes the characters look dumb just for the sake of storytelling.
Well, they do realize it, but then it's too late.
Yeah. That's storytelling, right? Like you're doing it to fit the story instead of the other way around. Like, which I felt like the third episode as well, which I don't know how not to reveal this, and I'll try to be as big as possible, where I feel like the chain of events that were happening at one point involving Nida Rahim were basically staged in a fashion so they would be timed properly and they would execute the fashion of drama and horror and not fitting how the character would actually behave.
Yeah,
that scene.
A bit too convenient.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, Broyden, do you want to call out any such moments where you felt that, you know, things are just not making sense?
Like, for instance, in the intro bit when the SWAT team is invading a space because they know they've got info that there's a terrorist there. You know, like simple things like, small things like, you know, the hand gestures that a tactical team might make to signal whether to stop moving or move. Those were again wrong, at least from what I can tell. And I looked up online as
so
well.
So what did
and
they do? They like
so basically, so when you if you want to tell your team to stop, like you raise your hand and you close your fist, right? Uh-huh. Which means stop moving.
Hmm.
But his hands were like open, like his palms were open basically.
Yeah.
And even after that, like, you know, once they actually get to the main guy who they are ordered to intercept, he's sitting on a chair and the main commando in charge goes up next to him and he doesn't know till now whether he is alive or dead, but he drops his, like, he puts his gun down and he just goes face first towards that guy. Why would you do something like that? And then that guy starts whispering something to him and all you can hear his subordinates like yelling, yeah, like, stop doing that, they're all a shoot, but nothing really happens. Like, you know, it just seemed very stupid.
Yeah.
Is all. I mean, just little attention to detail. Like, even for instance, again, not to give anything away, but as one of the inmates, once they get to that bunker area, explains how you go about, you know, if you want to call the ghoul, right? The ghoul is basically like a spiritual, an entity, basically. So it's as simple as drawing a symbol in blood, and that's it. And then the ghoul comes and then does your bidding or something. And even as things like, you know, when they show the person drawing that symbol, which he's got like out of his own blood. So he's drawing it with his fingers. But when you actually see the symbol, it clearly looks like it's been painted by a brush because it's so perfect. You know, all the lines are just, it's like a perfect symbol. Like, how is that even possible?
Yeah.
Like, it's just little things like these, which just shows like nothing was I the lack of attention to detail, I would say.
Yeah, so there were some places where I felt that there was good attention to detail in the sense that I mean, there was that scene where everyone starts getting nightmares, right? So over there, if you notice, Radhika Apte's character Nida Rahim, so they show like, okay, her armpits are sweating when like whatever she's sleeping, but the rest of her body does not. But that's how sweat begins, right?
Right,
it starts with the armpits. So some places, yeah, there was attention.
Okay,
to
I wasn't
detail.
Really paying attention to her armpits that much. I get your point. I guess they have done something, but
yeah, I mean, it's not like they're completely not paying attention to detail, but
there were some glaring omissions.
There were lots of these elements. Even when I saw like the way in which that whole tactical team dealt with that situation of arresting that Ali Sayed
exactly,
character,
yeah.
Was, you know, the guy is walking towards you, his like entire body is covered in a blanket, somebody's saying in your ear that okay, could be a bomb in his hand or something. How do you not shoot him when he's just like, you know, coming all the way towards you? He's not listening to your commands, anything. You're losing control of the situation entirely.
Exactly.
So I really don't know like how that works. And also, yeah, the stuff you mentioned later about him
going
to the
medic thing.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, how did anyone like not call for help in
exactly
that
like
scene?
So for those who are listening, basically there's a scene later on in the episodes where there are two guys part of this task force who are the first interrogation basically of Ali Saeed, and they are having a quarrel about some past argument, and one of the guys stabs the other one. And soon after that, the full team who have been waiting outside of the interrogation room burst into the room. And they see this guy slumping to the floor because clearly he has a knife in his chest. But all they do is detain the other guy who stabs him. And then you have the main characters come in and like realize, oh my God, you know, he's hurt. Medic, call medic, someone. Like, what were the other officers doing when they entered the room?
Their job was not to call the medic, no. They were hired for something
but that,
else.
It's just ridiculous. It's just like some of them were just laughable. Like,
yeah,
true. And it's not something you want in a horror film, to be honest.
Yeah. So anyway, what did you guys, like about episode 2 and 3? 1, I know we did appreciate it, but 2 and 3, is there anything to really worth watching?
There were some creepy moments. I like that they didn't do too many jump scares. They didn't really rely on that much. There was some eerie moments, and I guess it was shot kind of well. There was a bit of a creep factor to it towards the end, especially.
Yeah, I mean, considering that that whole prison that they got in.
Yeah.
They made it look really, old and broken down type of a place. And he even comments when they're entering. One of the guards says that
it's not
low
high tech.
It's perfect. Yeah. So that was a good setting to choose.
Yeah,
for...
it was good, and I guess it's. I didn't like really enjoy. It's definitely not like one of my favorite horror films or something. But it was okay, I guess. I mean, I didn't.
I mean, you don't think that you wasted your time by watching it?
I don't think I wasted my time. Yeah, I think it was worth it because it's not too long anyway. It's like watching like a longish movie.
Yeah, so. And support India. I mean, you know,
and all
Happy
that,
Independence
that
Day. Everything. Yeah.
I was actually thinking that what you just like last said, like when I was watching it, I was like, this should have been released on Independence Day because considering the overtones, like the timely and always relevant overtones of the social political aspects they were hinting towards in the first episode, at least. I was like, this is like a show literally made to be released on Independence Day. Mm. But obviously, they went into supernatural horror. I was like, okay, maybe not. Maybe it doesn't matter when you release it otherwise.
Yeah, exactly.
For me, what stood out in the second and third episode, I feel like, was the pacing, which was good, I guess, because it was initially a film and then a TV show. And because they weren't trying to like stretch it to like 6-7 episodes and have those like... Because normally Netflix has that sort of like... limit at least for other shows. Like it normally hits like I think at least 6, 8, or 10. And the fact that they allow the creators to be let it be 3 episodes and not have the story stretch for that long, made for good pacing, and it does not feel like stretching the story along. It goes about a good click and it gets done.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm actually happy that they chose to do this and not stretch it out, because we've seen this way too often in India and abroad also.
Yeah.
Prison Break should have ended in season 1. Yeah, but they stretched it, and then,
that's
what happened.
I feel
next.
Like multiple, like, I mean, every week almost, that there we need more miniseries. Like, instead of just creators trying to mine more seasons out of it, because they know there's a portion of returning audience, right? That's what creators do it, because they know people will come back because they're the same characters, people want to connect with them. The fact that you're courageous enough to like be like, no, this is the end, and just these many episodes actually allows you sometimes to tell better stories then.
Yeah.
Speaking of miniseries, I think everyone should watch Sharp Objects. I'm just putting it out there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually it's not related.
Yeah, it's not related to this at all, but yeah, do watch Sharp Objects.
Yeah, but...
That's psychological, almost horror, right? Psychological horror thriller. Yeah.
It is, yeah.
In a way,
is.
Yeah.
Yeah, personally, I feel that there is a lot of room for a ghoul prequel, if not a sequel.
Yeah,
where you can like sort of build on the stuff that you started with. But let's see if that happens. It'll take like an unusual, a series of unfortunate coincidences to happen for that sort of a thing.
It also takes like the creators have to be interested in that, right?
Yeah.
Because like what we have seen from these 3 episodes is the creators are clearly much more interested in telling a supernatural horror story.
Yeah.
As opposed to the political sort of sides of things that we are more interested in.
Yeah, so on a scale of maybe 1 to 10, where would you guys rate Sacred Games and then Ghoul?
Sacred Games, I would give it an 8, because I quite enjoyed that. Ghoul, I would say a 6.
Hmm.
I normally don't like giving ratings to things.
Yeah, I mean, just to like sort of...
But I think I'm pretty much around Royden's. Like, I would probably say 8.5 with Sacred Games, maybe in some parts, and then probably an 8. And probably Yeah, six sounds fine. Yeah, six.
Yeah, exactly. So we are looking forward to a bunch of other originals coming from Netflix later on. But based on like the evidence that we've seen so far, I mean, it's not like Netflix is just coming into India and making originals for the sake of making it. Even though, yeah, Ghoul has its weaknesses, I still think it's a pretty good show to watch one time. You know, you have a weekend free and you have nothing to do and you're in the mood to watch.
Yeah, and it's a little over 2 hours itself. It's not too
much
time.
Yeah, exactly. In 2 hours, you are done, essentially. Yeah. So that's the quality also sufficiently good enough that you can, I mean, you won't feel that you've wasted your time. And you know, there's always Sacred Games to show that, okay, they are into serious quality stuff as well. So partly, I think this show would have been maybe a little bit different had they sort of, had they been involved in the production process right from the beginning and, you know, not acquired it at the end. Yeah. Because a lot of things that they did, right, which is essentially like set the whole thing inside one prison, may have changed a bit if they had had more of a budget to work with from the beginning,
yeah, sure.
Which is something that I don't think they had when they started. So overall, it's good to see that, you know, these originals are coming in and hopefully we see more of these which are of pretty good quality. And I guess that's all we have for this episode of Transition, and we will see you with another episode next week. As always, don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube and Instagram at Gadgets360. And if you have any questions, comments or feedback, do write to us at podcast@gadgets360.com. The music for this episode comes via Magnus Solai Paulson, whose album PPP PPP is where the tracks are from. And if you like this show, don't forget to follow us on iTunes, which is Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, and Google Podcasts on your Android phone. Subscribe to this show over there. Thank you so much for listening.